This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The United States has waged war for the last 10 years, and yet the disconnect between the general public and those who actually fight these wars is greater than ever before. Technology that allows more destruction at a distance and the move to an all-volunteer army have made the horrors of war more remote to civilians. But that is a divide the two artists hope to bridge. Chris McElrone and T. Ryder Smith are men behind a stage production, Measure Back. It's a work that combines traditional theater with multimedia elements and audience participation to ask some tough questions about war. Measure Back is staged at Man Bites Dog Theater. It's part of Duke Performances, and it will be staged tomorrow through Saturday. Chris, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Also with us, T. Ryder Smith. Welcome to you.
Hey there.
So, Chris, let me start with you, where this idea came from. Tell us about it.
I started working on this with T back in 2009 at the Public Theater's Under the Radar Festival. And what drew me to the piece was just kind of witnessing what was happening in the world. I saw a mortgage crisis at the time. I don't own a home. I saw the stock market crash. I work in theater, so I don't have any real money. I saw two wars raging, and I had never been to war. And so I felt like a spectator and was looking for a piece where I could explore the idea of citizen as spectator and citizen as participant.
So, T, how do you stage this? Is there an architecture, a structure that you walk into the theater with?
There's two structures that sort of try to interrupt each other. The first one is based on our first book of war, which is the Iliad, which sort of sets a template out for how wars happen, the way things escalate from a violation to revenge to atrocity to grief and then scale back and then start with another offense, etc. So that sort of sets up a structure for the event itself. And the other element is something that I think every actor has certainly experienced, probably every audience member has experienced somewhere, if it's a second grade talent show or watching someone audition on television or watching a sporting event, which is the mistake, which then becomes an electric event in the room. We've probably all had that excruciating experience of sitting in a room, a theater, and watching an actor make a mistake or go up or a siren goes by outside or a dog. I was in a theater once. A bat got in the theater. You know, so, and something happens at that moment that is cannot be reproduced and is unique to that room that night. And what the actor does or what the audience does to sort of compensate for that or incorporate it into the event is the other structural element. We're trying to more or less rehearse mistakes and rehearse interruptions. So you set up a war in the room with the elements in the room, the audience. What would it take, we ask, for you and me to be at war? And then we try to find what the mistake is or what the interruption of that answer would be, rather than creating that smooth theatrical event that's very rehearsed. We're trying to create something that is predicated on what would happen if you then gave me the wrong answer to my line. What would happen if instead of turning to another character, I turned to an audience member and said, what do you think about this? So those are the two structures that play with each other.
So then, Chris, do we start with something that would be conventionally thought of as a play, actors sort of working together and in some kind of a scene?
Well, the piece starts with T coming out on stage and just being very honest about his experiences in life, the fact that he has never served in the military and his family has. And so it kind of steps through a family history to the point of T himself not having served in war. How can I understand what that is? I can understand that through my craft as an actor. And what does it take for someone, an actor, an individual, an audience member, to say, I understand. I understand what it means to be in conflict, to be in war, to be in love. And so it starts from a very simple place of an individual standing on stage, having a conversation, asking questions, and depending upon how those questions are answered, the event starts to unfold.
And can you understand those things is a fundamental question. As an actor, you're paid to perform as if you do, You're paid to play a soldier. You're paid to play some sort of agony. What is that based in? And do you even have the right to do that? Do any of us ever have the right to say, yes, we understand someone else's experience?
And this is how plays are created. I mean, if you think about a process, it starts as a sort of an intellectual exercise. You might question. But then it has to become embodied. It has to be acted out in front of us. Is that the evolution then of this theatrical event? Do we start with an idea and then watch it become embodied?
Yes, I think that's why we're calling it an event rather than a play, because a play has a structure that we're all familiar with. And it pretty much, just in dramaturgical terms, it resolves the problem. It will embody the problem with a character, et cetera. And the audience is always very passive, and they watch it unfold. So here we just thought, what if the process were the questions of creating the play itself? What do we do now? Come up here on stage. Help me with this. Move this over here. Stand over here. Play this character. Or give me lines, and where do we go from here so that you're more or less staging the process of writing a play, but you're using, instead of imaginary characters, you're using the real people in the audience to do it.
And do you do this, do you select your volunteers? You know, will you please come up, and they can obviously say yes or no, or do you just ask for a volunteer and wait for someone to walk up?
I think we do a little bit of both. Yeah.
Never know what you're going to get.
Well, that creates a kind of a tension when you think about war, or at least the way wars had been fought, that there is this uncertainty that goes along with it. Right?
Exactly so, yeah. You're asked to volunteer. You're given a role to play. You're given an order to follow. Do you follow it or not? And what are the consequences of following it or not?
Do you but the other interesting thing is that this question that I raised or posed, the idea that war creates uncertainty even for civilian populations, is no longer true in the United States. We don't, I mean, and that I think is part of the genesis of this show, isn't it? That these wars are being fought, bodies are coming home, tens of thousands of civilians with foreign names in foreign countries are dying. And, you know, we just have no sense of it at all. And none of the uncertainty that used to go with war is part of our experience. Is that what's behind some of what's behind this show?
Yeah, there's five television sets that play that sort of create a media saturation when the audience comes in. And we deal with the fact that there is no consequence in our personal lives for these things that we're ultimately paying for, literally and figuratively paying for these things to be done in our name for our comfort. And yet there's no consequence for us. So it's an attempt to try to find if we can embody some of that consequence in a theatrical metaphor. What if I just asked you to do something? Can we imaginatively project ourselves into thinking what that would be for someone in a situation?
Do your audience members act, or can they just get away with talking?
They act better than I do, certainly. They act better than I mean, this is painful to admit as a first-time playwright, but they write much better dialogue than I do.
Oh, really?
Yes. You ask them a question, and the things that come out of their mouths are just brilliant.
But that sort of raises the question. I mean, we do this show, for instance, live, and the reason is because it's a conversation. It is not an artifact. It's a thing that happens, and the production itself is the relationship between the host and the guest. So it's live. If I were to produce a drama, I'd never dare do it live because that's an artifact. Right. I mean, I would do it live, but it would be because that's a thing that's in the creator's hands, unlike this conversation, which I don't think is in my hands totally, rarely. So how does this differ from a conversation? Is it art? Is it an artifact? Or is it simply a forum, a public forum?
I think it is a conversation. I think theater in its best form is a relationship between a performer and an audience member. And if you can take that relationship and expand it into a conversation and a dialogue, then you can create something truthful and hopefully something meaningful in the room. And that's certainly the underpinnings of what we're doing here. You know, we're seeking to have a conversation and a dialogue about war and why we fight. And so that's another reason why we refer to it as an event as opposed to a play. You walk into a room and a conversation is going to unfold.
And war is a horrific conversation that already has a structure that is always ready to roll itself out. So the event can always return to war. And the Iliad again gets us a template for that. You can always say, well, next book, Odysseus enters and he says this. So we can structure the event that way. So it doesn't just run away with us.
How much change do you do? You start out with an idea and a question. Is there much in the way of sort of middle and end that you have points that you're aiming toward, or does it just go where it will after the first five words?
Before we came in the booth right now, we were doing some revisions based on what we had discovered this morning. It changes all the time.
How long have you been doing it?
Forever. It's been, 3 years now?
Almost three years. We started working on it in 2011. Mm-hmm. And so we just finished up a run in Pittsburgh at the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, the International Festival of Firsts, and we learned a tremendous amount about the piece. It's really difficult to rehearse a play with audience interaction.
You can't rehearse an audience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't rehearse an audience. And so as soon as we put it in front of an audience, we learned so much about the piece and have been feverishly working ever since.
You can't, and yet the audience is rehearsed, right? They've walked in, so they saw that there's a play about war. So that's the first filter, right? That group mm-hmm. of people. They've spoken about war. They have an opinion. And frankly, they wouldn't have laid down their $8 to come see your show. I don't know how much it costs. If they weren't interested in this. So there's some rehearsing that's gone on in their own mind, right? The dynamic, what you throw at them, that's brand new. They can't be ready for that. But in a sense, they're ready for something, right? Or they wouldn't be there.
I mean, we have all learned war, even if it's just in childhood games. If you ask someone, how do you make a gun with your fingers? Everyone knows how to do that. So we've been learning war all our lives, whether it expresses itself in a relationship or an act of road rage or how you treat your neighbors, racism, sexism, etc. These are all wars that we're surrounded by. So we all know the template of war. So we bring that into the room.
All right, you want to do some of this now? Can we do this? Is this something we can do now?
Ask you a question? Well, let me ask you, what would have to happen for you and me to be at war?
What would have to happen for you and me to be at war?
Would I that take means up too much room in the refrigerator?
You take up
would
too
I,
much room.
Beat
you would
your team in the playoffs for 86 years? What would I do?
To be at war, you would have to probably hurt somebody. You'd have to hurt somebody who really kind of mattered to me.
Okay.
I think that would be a hard thing for me to overcome.
Okay. And then we could ask you right now to imagine that person being hurt. Don't say it out loud. Yeah, just imagine it. Mm-hmm. And then I could ask you, how can you think that about this person you love?
How can I think what?
How can you imagine them being hurt that way? Where did that thought come from in you, et cetera? So we just follow through with that. And it becomes this exchange that we are all involved in. We catch ourselves thinking, if you ask someone, make a gun shape with your hand, how does a cowboy shoot? Everyone's going to know to sort of do a six shooter, hitting the hammer. And then you ask them, what does a cowboy shoot? Everyone will say Indians. And you think, where does that come from?
Right.
So, or if I asked you to point at me with a finger gun and put my hands in the air, how much time would pass before you just said bang? I would ask, why did you shoot me?
But the other thing to me that it strikes me that the difference between violence and violent behavior and motivations and all the questions that you're asking of me, which I think are great to walk me back to these kind of sources, is that war is decidedly a communal event. It's something that we all get stampeded into. If you think about this war in Iraq, how nobody had it on their horizon at all, and this constant drumbeat about these got a whole 80% of the population said, yes, go to war with Iraq. Mm-hmm. Where did that come from? And it was looking at your neighbor saying, well, you think it's okay to go to war, and then I think it's okay to go to war.
The building of consensus, And there's a character in the play who does that precisely with the audience.
Because that – and how much of that is there where you're trying to bring the whole audience into this and kind of marshal
– throughout. Yeah. They're often addressed as a group,
Not one-on-one.
And we certainly have moments where we seek to build consensus within the audience, and that kind of triggers how events unfold.
Do you get moments where people are sort of screaming at each other within the audience because they see what's happening and they're part of the 20% and say, my God, where have your heads gone?
We haven't had a live outburst yet, but we don't know what happens when they leave the room. Yeah.
So what has changed for you in your understanding of war in the 3 or so years you've been doing this?
How deeply it's based in how war is a macrocosmic expression of these microcosmic battles that we fight all the time. That it manifests, that war is a manifestation of things that are building up over over a long time on a daily basis, that all of these conflicts that we are taught as good practice in sports or in business or in a relationship wind up being, even aggressively driving, it winds up manifesting itself in something that we can no longer control, and that we are then, there's a consequence that we cannot encompass. We cannot fully come to terms with what we set in motion. And the very title itself is an attempt to measure back to these smaller events that will ultimately build up into war.
Do they always, I mean, because getting back to this communal aspect of war, the fact that it is social, right, that there's a connection, a bond among us that allows us all to go to war. Mm-hmm. Is that something that can be measured? In other words, what does it take for all of my anxieties and aggressions to be pooled into a consensus to go beat up on somebody else halfway across the globe?
I don't think we can demonstrate that. I think we can just plant the seed, as you just did. That question itself resonates in the room and informs the play when you think about it later. You leave the room and you think about it later. And I'd also just point out that there's a lot of humor in all of this, too. I mean, it's bleakly funny. It's blackly funny at certain moments. And there's a lot of hostility in humor that also manifests itself ultimately in violence. So humor is a very much – we don't want to make it sound like some grim lecture or something. I mean, there's a lot of laughter in the room as well, and it's a really bitter laughter.
What about activity? I mean, are you mostly talking, or are people asked to sort of shape with their bodies, to embody
and
move?
We use the body. Use the body on stage, yeah.
And do you have more than one person on stage at a time?
Sometimes most of the audience is on stage, yeah.
Yeah, I think we've got one moment. We have over 20 people on stage at once.
And what kind of reactions do you get? Are people generally shy, or at this point have they heard enough about you that they're there in order to be on stage?
Everyone is shy, and everyone given the slightest opening of the door becomes an exhibitionist.
It's kind of a technical question, but when you throw it open to questions, there's always the danger the monologist will take control.
We've had some comedians on stage, but that plays, I mean, that too is, you know, where do you take this? You take this to a place where you find it funny. Okay, well, let's make it even funnier. Let's make it even funnier than that. And when does it stick in the throat?
And like improv, I suppose, the more you do this, do you fall back on things that you did in year two and year one?
Or? Never works. Chris, right? Chris can test. But Chris just watches me flounder out there some nights because it really worked well last night.
The minute you try and repeat what you've done before, you kind of violate the underpinnings of it being a conversation with the group of people that are there that night. And so, you know, we try and keep it to the moment.
Is this the sort of thing, I mean, it's billed as a theatrical event or an event, and so then we're always trying to wrestle it back into what's the structure and how is it a play and all those kind of questions. So then you take it the other way and say, well, all right, let's take it out of the theater and make it a public forum. Let's get the mayor involved in this. I mean, have you had any thought about proposing this as a kind of a form for public forum?
It hadn't occurred to me.
We haven't had those conversations.
Talk about when we did Waiting for Godot in New Orleans. We had the seats set up, right?
We did a project, Waiting for Godot, in the Lower Ninth Ward in the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans. And every night we had three seats.
Post-Katrina.
Post-Katrina New Orleans. We had three seats reserved for the mayor, the president, and the director of FEMA.
And the audience coming in passed by those seats. Yeah. And there was some attempt to get them to come.
Yeah.
I mean, some people did actually say, you know, there's a seat waiting for you.
Well, we had
event.
One night in Gentilly where Mayor Nagin was to arrive and he didn't materialize.
Was Clint Eastwood ever in your audience? Because I think maybe that's where the idea.
He carries that chair with him. Yeah, I can't take credit for that.
Guys, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Sir.
Chris McElrone, T. Ryder Smith, creators of the stage production Measure Back, showing at Man Bites Dog as part of Duke Performances tomorrow through Saturday. For more information, go to our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, a look at heavy metal through the eyes of an African-American woman. Stay tuned.